This is Dale Harbin, and I am preparing a tape for Dr. John V. Jezierski, professor of history at Saginaw Valley College. This tape is being prepared on June 16th, 1972, in Bad Axe, Michigan. Bad Axe is the county seat of Huron County. With me today is Mr. Chet High. And we will discuss a branch of the utopian German colony called Harmony, which was established near Economy, Pennsylvania, shortly after the turn of the 19th century. As Harmony prospered and grew, it became necessary to form branches. In 1857, Reverend Emil Bauer, that's spelled capital B-A-U-R, along with 288 colonists who had affixed their signatures on the constitution of the new colony, called the Christian German Agricultural and Benevolent Society of Ora Labora, subsequently called Ora Labora, left for Michigan. Chet, what does Ora Labora mean?
Ora Labora, Ora et Labora. Work, or pray and work, really, if you put it that way, but work and pray. It's a Latin name. Ora, of course, is pray, and labora is work. And the original name would be on the original, most of the original books, is ora et labora. That means, just means ora et, would be pray and work. That'd be the German, the other way, you see. Instead of work and pray, it'd be pray and work.
Yeah. Chet, exactly where was the community located?
In what is known as Old Bayport. Old Bayport is between Bayport and Caseville on the Saginaw Bay. Of course, this would be closer to Bayport than, that's where the location would be, in what is known as Old Bayport.
Chet, do you happen to know what township that is?
Fairhaven.
How many acres did they purchase originally?
Well, their intention was to purchase 3,000 acres, rather, and that would be for 300 colonists. Each would have 10 acres, and that was the original intention of the colony, was to purchase 3,000 acres from the state of Michigan.
At what price per acre, Chad?
The prevailing price at that time was $1.25 an acre.
The colonists had difficulty obtaining final title to the land, Chet. Could you tell us what their problem was?
Well, one of the ladies that's highly skilled in the abstract work told me that the difficulty was that the state of Michigan sold the land to the colonists, and the state of Michigan did not own the land. The land belonged to the United States. So they had this difficulty. In order to obtain land from the United States, well, you had to get a patent. But now Earl Morton, who's the head of the abstract company here, and quite a historian, tells me that the United States did not charge them anything except just the bookwork. Because this was a religious organization, they donated the land, but they had to do this in order to get a clear title.
But the colonists still paid $1.25 to the state of Michigan. That money wasn't returned, was it?
Yeah, there's no account of that being returned.
In my research, Chet, I found out that an island was included in their tract of land. Could you tell us what the name of that island is?
Heisterman Island. It was named after Carl Heisterman, who was both a Mexican and Civil War veteran. He purchased it from the United States government.
About how far offshore is the island?
About 3 miles.
Did the colonists ever settle out there or put the island under any type of agricultural effort?
I never found any record where they did. At that time, there was a tribe of Indians occupied Heisterman Island, And Heisman himself and his wife lived there with the Indians. But I don't know of any of the Ora Labora settling on Heisman Island. They settled on the shore.
Were these Chippewa Indians?
They were all Chippewa Indians.
Also, the question occurred to me is why Reverend Bower selected Huron County in view of a letter that Governor Class sent in which he stated that the area, which included Huron County, could, quote, never be of any importance, end of quote.
Well, there is a report that Reverend Bower, report that the governor made was made in about 1847, but Emil Bower looked over the report and he wasn't satisfied with it, so himself and a party, not too long after this report was made, came here as we would call kind of an advance guard, or an advance for the Ora Labora. Well, they'd be checking the governor's statements, and Reverend Bower didn't agree with this at all. He thought with plenty of work, might say elbow grease or whatever they called it then, that this could be made into very fine farmland.
This letter that is referred to in some of the research papers was not directed directly to Reverend Bower.
I don't believe it, no. I think it was just a general statement made by the governor who didn't know what he was talking about, I guess.
How did the settlers reach Michigan, Chad?
Well, they finally wound up by boat, but just exactly, there's a little difference of opinion. They came down the Ohio River, some, and then they got over into Lake Erie. But the first settlers came in quite a large boat.
Did they bring any livestock with them?
They said they did bring livestock with them, and some of the older settlers said they had to push the livestock into the water and had it swim ashore, or else, you know, the water wasn't deep enough for that. But they did bring some livestock with them, particularly oxen and cows.
Could you describe the ceremony that took place as the colonists waded ashore?
Well, I think the first thing they did was build an altar, and each member of the colony furnished that would pick up a stone and furnish one stone for this altar, which was an altar dedicated to this Christian society, or to this movement, or to the colony. And they had skilled workmen with them, and no doubt they cemented these stones together and made a very nice altar.
Was this altar built immediately upon their arrival?
I've always been told that the first thing they did actually was build the altar and dedicate it to the colony as a Christian. It was their, kind of like you would say, they took the land in the would be a Christian. For Christian purposes, that would be it. For religious purposes, that would be probably more like it.
Chet, could you describe the village and how it was laid out?
Well, the most houses there ever were in the village. They had 75 houses, buildings were built, and they were neat rows, and they were all about the same, except there was one building. It was known as a community building. They used that for, for community purposes. And I imagine that in the beginning it was also used as a church, but this building, in 1930, I went with the editor of the Huron News, that would be Cal Shoemaker, and part of this building was still in existence. Some of the logs were there and the foundation, but it was the only building left in 1930 when we wrote an article on it. And other buildings disappeared somewhere.
So it was a total of 75 buildings, which included their community building and probably a grist mill or whatever.
Yes, and might have even included if they had Arch Barn or something. But anyway, there were 30, the count said they had 75 buildings were erected.
What was the surrounding area like, Chad?
Well, it was swamp, woods, swamp. Lots of mosquitoes, of course. They had a lot of trouble with that, and the water was poor. And it was just it was virgin wilderness and lowland, a lot of it.
Well, by 1965, 8 years after they arrived, they only had 160 acres under cultivation. I suppose the reason would be is because of the difficult work involved.
Yes, the work was very difficult because of the nature of the land. It was quite low at that time. Of course, at this time there was no drainage, and they had built a dock there so boats could land all right. And the one of the things that might have been held up the clearing of the land was they had to get almost everything had to be brought from Bay City by boat, and that was slow. And they took some things to clear the 160 acres of land at that time was a lot of work. Yeah.
Well, besides then the physical difficulties they faced, what other problems did the colonists have?
Oh, they had there was quite a bit of sickness, and The report says there was a lot of poverty among the members of the colony. They came to seek religious freedom. They got that, but they had no work to do and couldn't earn any money. And they had that difficulty, and then they had quite a bit of malaria, and they made, some of them made alcohol beverages for the it was about the best thing they used for malaria, and then there were some of them were skilled in using herbs too for malaria. But they had quite a bit of trouble with that because the water naturally would be very impure.
You mentioned that they had Chippewa Indians as neighbors. Did the community have any difficulty living among the Indians?
Not at all, no. The head of the Indians at that time was Brilliant Rising Sun, and he was very friendly Indian, and they had no difficulty with the Chippewa Indians at all. And I might say here that there was very few Sauk and Fox and other Indians around. The Chippewas had drove them out. I understand the Chippewas and the Sauk had quite a battle, and the Chippewa was a peaceful Indian though.
By 1965, then, the colonists were apparently fairly well settled. Could you tell me what the population was at that time? They arrived with 288. Was there any growth, or was there a decline?
Quite a decline. It was almost half. As the best that I could find was a little over half of the people remained, and the others must have gone home, or they went down to New Harmony in Indiana. There's a New Harmony in Indiana. Some of them went down there in 1850. See, that would be, they must have got there pretty early. But it was organized in 1850. Some of them went to Indiana because it was cleared, you know, and easier. Naturally, that was a tough life there.
Yeah. Well, you say that Oralabora was a distinctly religious community. Did their religious convictions prevent them from serving in the Civil War?
No, they believed in freedom. They were against slavery. And most of them had, naturally, from coming from Germany, they had military training, and good military training. And I don't think they drafted any of them. I think that they volunteered to fight for freedom. It's part of their religion, really, that a man should be free to and they were against slavery.
Could you tell us or explain to us what caused the decline of the community and its eventual disbanding in 1871?
Well, there might be other reasons. There is a few given, but quite a lot of the men that had military training and joined the Union Army. When I was just a boy, my father used to invite some of these people to come to our home. And these people from the colony who fought in the Civil War, and we always looked on to them, looked to them almost as heroes, you know. And they took so many of the men for military, so many of them left for military service. They had nothing to do much at the colony. There wasn't enough work around. So they had two things. They got work, and then they fought for a cause that they believed in, and that's freedom of mankind.
Are there any descendants of the original colonists living in the area at the present time?
Oh, yes. There's quite a lot of them. Sometimes some of the supervisors will turn up whose grandfather. And I'll take, like, Fred Kindy of Bad Axe. His father was a wagon maker in the colony. And, there's quite a few of them around Bayport. Their grandchildren or great-grandchildren. Some of the Bowers living around. Paul Bower, Walter Bower, and there's different ones that are related to Emil Bower, the grandsons or great-grandsons. Yeah, there's still some of them around. In fact, they did a great deal toward clearing up that land in through there, which is actually, as the Reverend Bower said, it's fertile land. It's good land.
Also, you mentioned before that Mrs. Agnes Bosch, B-O-E-S-C-H, had also studied the community of Ora Labora. Is she still living?
Oh, yes. A teacher. I think she's teaching. And I'll say she did. I think she spent about a whole year at this, and she was very careful to get things right. I took an interest when I saw that once she come across something that she couldn't explain and it wasn't clear, she said so. And of course, that's the best thing to do. There's no use guessing at something. She was very accurate. Now this, the date, you know, that where the difficulty came in quite often. Now in 1857, they were absolutely there, no question about it. But the lawyer that helped me, the late Alfred Sauer, he said they were there considerably before 1857. He was very good at deeds, and he donated a great deal of his time toward Durham County history. But he said they probably were there even before 1850. But there was not much of a record because they didn't own the land. And I believe that actually it took almost 15 years to get a title to some of that land because of the state and United States. The United States owned the land, and the state sold it. But the United States was very nice about it. They wrote some patents over in the abstract office of Bad Axe. These people got patents from the United States, and they also got a title that they bought it from the state. See that? And the title would be clear. But it was about hitched because in 1847 or 48, I think about the first deeds that we could catch coming through there were 1862. That's about 15 years. But that's a long time, but that's adverse possession. They couldn't get it either because of the fact that it was government land and state land. But anyway, it seems a long time to get titled to anything, but some people have to wait. They waited a long time. They lived on it a long time.
Well, maybe that title problem also slowed down the development. Maybe that's why they only had 160 acres under cultivation. What do you think?
Well, no, that's a good idea. I believe that that could easily... Because this lady, as I said, Mrs. McFadden, now she's around about 90 years of age, and she was about as good in on abstracts. She worked with me on two histories, and she said they had serious difficulty getting a clear title. And so we went over to the abstract office, and I think the first clear...
Oh, sorry for the interruption. We had a phone ringing in our office here, but let's go ahead, Chet.
And then speaking of Aura Labora, you know, it was really supposed to be all the people living together in Christian harmony, and but they were a lot like we are today. The harmony didn't always last. Now, there was one incident, one of the sons of one of the members of the colony said there was a sign, of course, as you went came down on the main, it was on the main building, the community building, Aura et Labora. And then they put underneath pray and work. But we'll say the big chiefs of the colony were quite surprised when they came home. They'd been somewhere in Bay City and they saw a sign just about opposite from it. It said in German, Fluch und Fall der Raut. That means swear and then loaf around. That's really what it means. And they had quite a time about that. They made them take it down, of course. But it just shows that they were human. And we could, too, add that Aura Labora had many skilled workers there. They could shoe oxen, horses, and they could make, do all kinds of steel work, make locks, and they could make wagons. But there was no sale for this stuff around there, so they had a pretty tough time. And to wind it up, we would say that we owe a debt to these wonderful German people, the industrious, thrifty people that came here and did the first work in digging or clearing up the land there and bringing out one of the finest farming countries in Huron County or almost in the state of Michigan. Part of this land is known as the Garden Spot of Michigan. These people deserve a great deal of credit coming there in that mosquito and malaria-infested swamp and working. And they cleared land, and they were kind of like, they went ahead and made a start at it, like building a foundation. And all that land through there now is very valuable, practically all of it. And there's I'd give them credit for their spunk and what they did to help build up Huron County. Of course, we included a little kind of a joke in there because I guess that was, the fella told me, was a preacher anyway, so it, but he didn't mind it at all. I think the very important thing is that these people came here and settled there. They put up a sawmill. They built their own buildings, saw their own lumber, and they cleared their own land, and they had to travel all the way to Bay City for practically everything that they purchased. I think they did a great service to humanity, and I think we should also pat them on the back for their service in the Civil War. Now, some say that some of them, a few of them, took leave because of this war, but I never ran across it. When they were asked to serve the United States in the Union Army, that any of them that were free to go and physically, that they went and volunteered. I don't think that the draft had reached them. They were not citizens yet of the United States. They tell a little, in history you got to be careful. They tell of another little settlement there that when they started drafting or calling them for the Civil War, they all went back home. And after the war was over, they came back again from another spot. We won't mention what it is, but there's some truth to it. Some of them did leave the country just as soon as the draft. But In the Civil War, if you had $300, you could buy your way out. So it was a poor guy that got hooked there. The wealthy fellow, they called it bounty. I don't know why. They paid $300 and give it to some other soldiers to go in. And that, of course, cleared them of military duty. But the poor guy, $300 at that time would be probably like $2,500 to $3,000 now. And but these people, I don't think that bothered them any. I don't think they were included in the draft. They volunteered their service and served with the Michigan outfits.
Well, Chet, I've been up to the location of Orla Bora myself, and it's located on what is called now Old Sand Road. And I've noticed that about a quarter of a mile to a half a mile from the site of Orla Bora, back towards Bayport on Old Sand Road, there's a cemetery. Was that cemetery established after Orla Bora, or are some of the citizens from Orla Bora buried there?
I think some of the citizens from there. I don't think very many of them. What's happened when we went there, I haven't been there for a long time, is the stones that were set up were tipped over, and they kind of, I think that they're buried there, but some of the markers may not be intact. But Mr. Eckstein, who worked with me on the Huron County Centennial History, and I, we went in the cemetery to check it over, you see. But we didn't get so very far. It was just a very simple little thing. It wasn't mosquitoes either. It was poison ivy. All those graves were lousy with, just covered. Just seemed to be the kind of material. And neither Mr. Eckstein, who has departed since from life, who was very much interested in those things, we didn't want to risk that poison ivy, and I suppose in some cases, oh. But those stones were just covered with it. And if you stepped into it even on a hot day, you'd be liable to pick up this poison ivy on some people. So we didn't go reading too many of them. There's no way of getting around.
Hey, speaking of Old Sand Road, I understand that at some point, and this was during the time that Orla Bora was active, that there was a stagecoach that ran through that area. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, yes. The stagecoach operated from, well, it'd be from, it went off the shore, and one end of it would be at Port Austin. And I used to know, of course, years ago, the man who drove that stagecoach, that has made one of the trips at least, from Port Austin, a man by the name of Facer, F-A-C-E-R, and he used to tell about the trips they made there, and traveled on the sand road because it was the only road then. The other was practically all, the sand road followed the shore, and other roads were, well, there wasn't any other roads really. That was the only road there was that followed along on the sandy beach there, and it was sand.
And what was the exact route of the stagecoach, do you know?
Well, it followed the shore around here. We took it around, another fellow and I, we started early in the morning and drove the sand road from over around in Sebring through there and come all the way around, all the way on the shore. And it was sand and ridges. They call it ridge road some, too. It was higher. Of course, they had to pick the high land. And I'll tell you how tough it was even in later years. We started early on a Sunday morning. We didn't hardly get around Huron County, which was 90 miles until night. But that would be, some of the road was so sandy that you almost had to miss it.
Well, where did the stagecoach start, and where did it end?